Hello and welcome to the first episode of the JN Podcast. I'm Phil Dave, and each week on this program, we are going to be bringing you some of the biggest Jewish news stories that are impacting our community. We'll give you more of an in-depth look with the people at the center of those stories, and we'll also be delving through some of the pages of your copy of the Jewish newspaper itself to make sure that you are fully abreast with what is happening in the world of Jewish news. On this week's program, we'll be meeting Neil Wigan OBE, who of course is the British ambassador to the State of Israel. We'll be finding out how Israel has been celebrating Yom Ha'atzmaut under lockdown, or of course its 72nd Independence Day. We'll also hear the thoughts of city editor for the Daily Mail, Alex Brummer, as he tells us what he believes the state of the economy in this country really is like in the midst of COVID-19 and just how long it could potentially take us to recover from it. And as if all of that isn't enough, we'll be hearing the truly inspiring words of Dr. Jonathan Behar, who is ordinarily a consultant cardiologist at the Royal Brompton, but this week and many other weeks, I dare say, he finds himself battling the forefront of COVID-19 at the NHS Nightingale over in Excel in London. We'll hear from him later on. Let's start off, though, this episode of the JN Podcast, as we mean to start all episodes with a look through your copy of the Jewish News. And joining me to go through it, I'm delighted to say, is editor Richard Ferrer and supplements editor Bridget Grant. Welcome to you both. Now, before we get started, I think I should just apologise in advance for the compromise you may hear in sound quality. I have to tell you, though, that is because we, of course, are working from home, like everyone should be doing wherever possible. And as a result of it, there's only so much you can get away with sounding like you are in a radio studio. So I hope you will bear with us. But both Richard and Bridget, welcome officially to this first episode of the JN Podcast. Let us delve straight in and have a look on the front page. And the headline reads, Israel's leaders are violating our values.
Yeah, can I just say, Phil, how lovely it is to be working with you again. The community's finest broadcaster. Really excited that we're doing this project.
As am I, Richard. It's very kind of you to say so. I do think, though, that the title of finest broadcaster probably belongs to one or two others, but thank you very much all the same.
Well, I don't know them. So, yes, we have got a front page that has gone down as well as a pork chop at a virtual bar mitzvah. We have got Mick Davis, who, for those who don't know, former chairman of the JLC, former chief executive and treasurer of the Conservative Party, one of, if not the biggest UK donor to Israel. So, I mean, this man's got a CV. He has said that the diaspora is being failed, being violated by Israeli politics and Israeli leaders. I'll give you just a quote. I mean, this is a 1,000-word piece he's written for us. He said, Palestinian dysfunction, corruption and intransigence were previously an obstacle for Israel to overcome, not a set of values for it to emulate. I mean, that's pretty scathing stuff, and it's the sort of scathing analysis of the Jewish state that will be hard, if not impossible, for many in our community to accept. There is a huge divide between the left and the right in our community, and I'm a devoted advocate of Israel, as anybody who knows me will recognise. But, and I understand the pressures it faces. But I can see there is some constructive criticism here that will be very, very tough for a lot of pro-Israel advocates to take.
You see, this is the problem, isn't it? Is because that it depends how diehard one is in terms of defending Israel and all that she does. And the awful truth is that every country does make mistakes here and there. So it can be quite a bitter pill to swallow when you have someone like Sir Mick saying something like this, because there may be elements of truth in it, but at the same time, do any of us really want to admit it?
Well, we've got to a point now where the avowed opponents of Netanyahu, people like Gantz, who absolutely swore blind they would never facilitate a Netanyahu government, have, for their own reasons, decided to do that. I mean, Netanyahu is now going to remain prime minister for at least another 18 months. If the patchwork coalition holds out, which there is no guarantee that it's going to, it could fall apart within weeks. But what we're talking about here, as far as Mick's concerned, is the breakdown of liberal democratic values. And he's calling that an existential challenge to the relations with the diaspora. The values that we see in Israel and we like to see in ourselves is being eroded by the lack of decorum and the lack of ethics currently in the Knesset. It's dynamite stuff, and it's gone huge online. As you can imagine, the right wing of the community are up in arms, and the left wing are saying that these are some home truths that need to be told by a friend.
Quite extraordinary times. But of course, I suppose that at the moment, even if the coalition government in Israel does disintegrate in the way that we have experienced in recent times with the other coalitions that have been there, there is a bigger battle on our hands, and we're not going to completely ignore the fact that the paper is awash, like many other, with COVID-19 related articles. Too many to mention in a 10-minute paper review, I fear.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get Bridget in. In fact, this is the longest I've ever been on a call with Bridget where she hasn't spoken, so I'm a bit worried she may be asleep. Are you there? Hello,
I'm here. I'm listening. I'm listening. I was against the Samik thing, but because I just thought, oh, it's Yom HaTzmaut, and obviously we covered that in the paper. But at the same time, having read what Mick Davis said, I mean, everyone should read it. In fact, it's a packing paper, Richard. I'm very proud to be part of something that's coming out under these circumstances. It's not easy under COVID, and producing a paper particularly has its challenges. But it's full of, you know, really good, powerful stuff. And yeah, COVID is part of it. That extraordinary story that you've done on the man who was found, has got no family, that's in the paper, that Stephen, one of the writers, has found out. Is that right? All sorts of people that to kind of find out the identity of this man with no relatives so that in death he would have some dignity and be identified. That's a story that's in the paper.
This is a gentleman, a 95-year-old guy called Max, who died all alone in his house in January. And then through an incredible genealogical pursuit, really, by the community, they managed to trace his lineage back to the father of modern Hebrew, Ben Yehuda, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, I believe his name is. It's an extraordinary tale, and certainly something that I think merits close attention in the paper this week. In terms of COVID, though, I mean, you've got the chief rabbi this week warning that it's disgraceful that certain elements of our community are flouting the lockdown. The police had to put a prohibition notice on a shul in Hackney this week. Our listeners will, of course, be aware of the fact that there was a Golders Green wedding last week that was shut down, and the father of the bride was a police liaison officer. So there is some serious issues in terms of the extraordinary. He had to stand down. There are some extraordinary issues and examples of people flouting this ban. And if you look over to Israel, back to Israel we go, there was an amazing stat here, and I don't want to focus on COVID too much, I know we've got other things to talk about. There are currently in Tel Aviv Yafa 532 cases. Meanwhile, in B'nai Barak, which is the center of Haredi Judaism, one of the centers in Israel, very, very orthodox, there are 2,816. So that's 500 in Tel Aviv, and in B'nai Barak, 2,800. But it just goes to show that certainly in more traditional areas of Jewish communities where you know, community and group organized events are so important, people are finding it incredibly difficult to lock down, pin down, isolate, and do the right thing.
It all comes down to their leaders, though, doesn't it? Because obviously these people, you know, they tie themselves to whatever the leader of that community says. So it's the like in every community where they follow it, the leaders are not saying enough. And also it's very difficult because, I mean, certainly in Stamford Hill, friends of mine who are liberal, to say the least, are saying that it's horrendous because non-Jews are turning around in Stamford Hill and talking about what a drain they could potentially be on the local Homerton Hospital and so on when they get sick. Mm. So it's not great. It's not great for us as a people, this kind of press, really.
It certainly isn't. But one thing that potentially is great for press is that on page 11 of the paper this week, we've got critical friends for 70 years, the ups and downs of seven decades of UK-Israel diplomatic relations. Of course, we are going to find out a little more about this when we speak later on in this very programme to the British ambassador for Israel, that is Neil Wigan OBE. But that's coming up in just a moment's time. For now, let's look at what it says in the paper.
What's great about this, I think, is that, I mean, I sometimes you struggle and you're on a back foot when you try and explain British-Israel relations. And this is literally a little pocket guide to help people kind of navigate what the relationship is and how it has been for the past 70 years. So now when people start with you on the subject, you have the information here, and it doesn't require excessive reading because it's all bite-sized bits of information according to each decade. So I think it's really, really valuable, but not as valuable as the piece that I did on the DJs. If your children were about to go to Ibiza this summer, and it is a rites of passage, you know, Ibiza, Mallorca, Ayia Napa, and of course all of that has been cancelled, and there are three Jewish DJs very well known. One of them is Julius O'Riordan, who is better known as Judge Jules, has a huge following, you know, paid umpteen thousands to travel the globe to appear at festivals and clubs all over the world. And he is all of these guys, Stephen Ortman in Spain and Brandon Block, who is in Northwood, are still streaming from their living rooms. Brandon, in addition to doing the music streaming, is also very involved in mental health. So he does support groups. He had Johnny Benjamin there last week, actually, helping people who in lockdown are struggling with mental health issues. And they're well-attended forums, actually, online. He does Zoom with them, and everyone gets a chance to speak. And it's actually, I mean, I attended one of them, and it was really good. So if anyone's struggling with their kind of mental health at this point, or know someone who is, it's a very, very friendly support group. But these guys are amazing. And if you've never heard them, and you wondered what your children were going to be dancing to if they had gone to Ibiza, these guys, Judge Julius and Stephen Ortman and Brandon Block, kind of give you a flavour of it.
Certainly does. That's on page 22 of the Jewish News for this week, but that's all we've got time for a look at the paper. I don't think that was too bad for our first attempt, so thank you very much to Supplements editor Bridget Grant and editor Richard Ferrer. Thank you both. Keep well.
You too, Phil, and stay safe.
This is the JN Podcast. Now, this week, Jews around the world, despite lockdown, have been marking Yom Ha'atzmaut, or Israel's Independence Day. For obvious reasons, the Jewish state's 72nd birthday was really rather different, to say the least. So let's find out how she marked it by speaking to British Ambassador to the State of Israel, Mr. Neil Wigan, OBE. Your Excellency, thank you so much for joining us on the JN Podcast. It's very much appreciated. Can we establish, first of all, how did you spend your first Yom Ha'atzmaut in Israel as an ambassador? Because I'm guessing it must have been a bit different because of lockdown.
So I did celebrate it the traditional Israeli way with a barbecue in my garden, as I'm lucky enough to have a garden. But obviously, as you said, for most Israelis, they couldn't celebrate it as they normally would, including the set piece events to honor Israel's dead. But there were some lovely touches with planes which usually do a flypast over Tel Aviv, instead doing a flypast over individual hospitals to say thank you to them for all that they were doing.
Oh, wow. How lovely. And was there anything in particular that maybe you had planned, or maybe the country as a whole had planned, that obviously had to change because of lockdown? You mentioned the flypast, but was there anything else that sort of typically couldn't happen because of lockdown?
So it's obviously where families tend to get together, and my wife's family is in Israel, so we would have liked to spend the day with them, but sadly we're unable to. But as with Passover and other festivals, we're using Zoom or other ways of staying in touch to celebrate.
You and your colleagues, how have you been spending recent weeks? Because obviously I'm guessing at the embassy it must be quite hustle and bustle normally, and obviously that's changed for not just you but for the whole country. So how have you managed to keep the embassy going and the work you have to do going?
So obviously, personally, it's been frustrating because the best part of the job for me and all of us is getting out and about and meeting people and traveling around Israel rather than being stuck at our desks. But actually, professionally, it's been really busy. We've been finding new ways of doing diplomacy, so using Zoom, WhatsApp, and actually that's let us have some conversations which we probably wouldn't have done otherwise. There have been some nice moments. So I had a meeting with President Rivlin in his garden with just the four of us because of the new regulations, but that was a lovely experience. But we've really been focusing on trying to get Israeli and British experts to talk to each other about different approaches to combating coronavirus and how we can work together on that.
Well, let's talk a bit about that, actually, because that was something that I have every intention of asking you, because obviously it's no hidden secret that Israel is phenomenal in the way that it progresses with medicine and it combats various diseases and cures and treats and all sorts of things. The medicine there is phenomenal, no doubt about it. How has Israel been working with the UK and indeed other nations in order to try and do something about combating this latest strain of coronavirus?
So it's been a whole spread of things. So some things have been public health experts talking about what's the best approach to social distancing, what's the best approach for coordinating government responses, right through to the real experts talking about vaccine development, which is obviously the ideal way out of this, but everything in between, including how do we use technology for contact tracing, how do we use apps and so on, and sharing expertise between the two countries.
Now, of course, this coincides with the 70th anniversary of UK-Israel relations. Just give us a bit of an insight into that.
So it's really wide-ranging. So what gets most attention is the political cooperation, and we do a lot of that. And we also work very closely with Israel on the threat from the Iranian nuclear program and Iran's activities in the region. We do a lot of security cooperation with Israel. That's really increased in the last 3 years. But what's really an important part of the relationship now is the economic relationship, the technology relationship, and the science relationship. And those have all really grown much, much stronger since I was last here 15 years ago.
Is there any danger, for want of a better term, that the coronavirus could, shall we say, obstruct the progress between growth in trade between Israel and Britain?
So obviously, corona is having economic effects across the world, so we will all be affected. But actually, for example, a big part of the economic relationship is Israel exports a lot of pharmaceuticals to the UK used by the NHS. So that clearly will remain very important. And a lot of the relationship is around high tech and technology, and that we expect will recover relatively quickly coming out of corona. And I hope that the concrete cooperation in collaborating against corona, that we'll then see that feed through in the science relationship and in the technology relationship in the future.
Israel was without doubt one of the leads in the world in terms of putting in place really strict and stringent safety measures. And as a result of it, it certainly at surface value seems to have paid off. Thank God for Israel. Now, of course, we're seeing the UK starting to do the same in bits and pieces. But what can the UK, do you think, learn from Israel? And did Israel maybe at any point urge the UK to behave differently? Because I believe that was the case with Israel and Austria.
No, sir. Our exchanges have much more been about professionals exchanging their experience, what has worked, what hasn't worked. I think the Israelis have been very good at saying not everything that we've done's worked. This is the different approaches that we're trying, and this is why they're going behind it. And they've been very interested in hearing from the UK what we're doing, what our thought process is, and of course, our leading scientists and researchers. So it's been much more that two-way exchange of information, and of course a recognition that there are big differences between the UK and Israel, so we will learn from each other, but it doesn't mean that what works in one context would work in the other.
There is the talk of an application for our mobile phones over in the UK coming into force in the not-so-distant future, but Israel has sort of had phone alerts in place pretty much since the beginning. How has that worked, just so we get a rough idea of potentially what's coming our way?
So the way it worked in Israel is they developed an app very early on that stored all the data of, for that phone, what other phones it had been in near contact to, so that if somebody had been in contact, so that you would receive an alert if you'd been in contact or in close proximity to somebody who had tested positive for corona.
Which is, of course, just another fantastic example of just how advanced Israel is. Okay, I think that we need to, please God, put coronavirus to one side, because there will be some who definitely want to hear about you, and obviously that you are still fairly new, technically speaking, to the role as British ambassador to Israel. I believe that you took the post in June, is that right, last year?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so is there any particular part of the role that has maybe surprised you? You know, was there anything that you weren't expecting, apart from coronavirus, expecting to have to deal with?
So I think everybody in Israel is used to dealing with the unexpected. And I think sometimes that can be political security events. So the death of Qasem Soleimani obviously had a big regional impact, and we were talking closely to the Israelis about that. But then on the positive side, there was Prince Charles's visit for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And that was a really special part of my time here. I mean, more broadly, I think I have been struck by the depth of the relationship. As I said, I was here 15 years ago when the relationship was much more focused on the political side, and how much cooperation there is going on science or on high technology or on cybersecurity. That's really struck me on this time here.
More importantly, I've heard it through the grapevine, and I have some quite good sources here at the JM podcast, that your Hebrew is coming along a bit of a treat. I understand that your wife, Yael, is she your teacher? And do you now converse in Hebrew at all to her?
We do sometimes talk in Hebrew. I do have another Hebrew teacher as well, so my wife doesn't take the full burden. My Hebrew is still less good than it should be, but I am testing it on Fauda and other Israeli TV shows to see how much progress I'm making.
Well, that sounds pretty impressive to me, and I wonder whether or not I might be allowed to, and forgive me, Your Excellency, but to put you on the spot and to see whether or not you might be prepared to maybe offer our listeners, say, a greeting for this first podcast, but in Hebrew.
Oof. Ani mekaveh shekulam shamayim alcha podcast hazeh shechem vechachem mishpachot shelachem shechem smachim velachem brecha im ha-matzav sheyesh lanu achshav.
So I got bits of that, and I'm not even going to attempt to translate it just in case I make a total fool of myself. What did that roughly mean?
I wish everybody who is listening to this podcast and their families happiness and health in this situation.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way in which to end it. Your Excellency, Mr. Neil Wigan, OBE, British Ambassador to the State of Israel, thank you so much for speaking to me on the JM podcast.
Thanks very much, Phil.
So there you have it. That is what Yom Ha'atzmaut in lockdown in Israel looks like. Thank you very much to His Excellency there. Okay, well, each week on this programme, we are going to try and obtain the thoughts of someone in the know for as long as we have to deal with this coronavirus outbreak. In particular, we'll try and look at the economy and how we are trying to deal with the mathematics behind this virus, and ultimately what it means for us here in the UK and probably the wider world. This week, we get the thoughts of Alex Brummer, who is city editor at the Daily Mail.
So I think that the interesting thing now about the corona crisis, the pandemic, is how it's transformed from being not just a medical emergency, but becoming a business, financial, economic emergency as well. Indeed, the numbers are becoming quite alarming in all sorts of ways. So I was just looking at the unemployment numbers, for instance, in the United States, which have gone up by another 3 million this week, which means they've nearly got 30 million people unemployed since this crisis broke out, which is absolutely astonishing. Coming closer to home, I think we're beginning to see the same sort of impact in the UK. We're seeing that the claims against universal credit, that's the social security system, are up at around 3 million now, which is a very big number, much bigger than it was. In fact, before this crisis, the UK had a fantastic unemployment. Very few, all those vacancies or half of those vacancies have now been cleared away. And we're also seeing great financial strains on the economy. So the money that the government is spending to support the economy is absolutely soaring. So I've seen new numbers in the last 24 hours, which suggests that the budget deficit, that's the amount the government is going to borrow, is going to soar by about 120 billion. That's 120 billion pounds in this current financial year. That puts it way above where we were in the period immediately after the banking crisis of 2008, 2009, 2010. So we're in unknown territory. Now, of course, there is a theory around that this will be short and sweet, and because people have been put on furlough, kept in work in all sorts of ways, that the economy will bounce very strongly, kind of V-shaped recovery. I'm very suspicious of that. I think this is going to be much more drawn out. The medical numbers are not coming down fast enough. The admissions, the number of deaths, and the lockdown doesn't look as if it will be eased that much anytime soon. So this is going to be prolonged, difficult, and hard to come out of. And I'm now beginning to predict that we're heading into the worst downturn for the UK economy and the global economy since the Great Depression, and that takes us right back to the 1930s. Much worse, in fact, than occurred during the Second World War.
City editor at the Daily Mail, Alex Brummer, sharing his thoughts on the outbreak of coronavirus and what it means for our economy here in the UK and possibly the wider world. This is the JN podcast. Now, it's probably fair to say that there's hardly a person in the world right now who isn't somehow affected by the coronavirus. However much we may find the disruption to our everyday lives an inconvenience, think for a moment, if you will, about those brave individuals who are on the front line battling. And of course, this is our amazing NHS. Our next guest is just one of those heroes. Dr. Jonathan Bihar is a consultant cardiologist and an electrophysiologist at the Royal Brompton and Harefield Hospital, but he is now found at the NHS Nightingale over in Excel, and I'm honoured to say he joins us now. Dr. Bihar, thank you so much for speaking to us. First and foremost, how are you doing?
So, hi, very nice to chat with you, Phil. And I'm okay. Thank you very much for asking. It's been a very tough and grueling couple of weeks.
I should imagine that's the understatement of the century, because to be honest, it's quite tough and grueling to watch it unfold from the comfort of one's living room. And I can't even begin to fathom what it must be like on the front line, as it's being dubbed, because that's exactly what you are doing. You are obviously one of a number of amazing NHS staff who are trying to help as many people through this as possible. Can you give us a bit of an insight into what your work schedule has become?
Yeah, so essentially a number of weeks ago now, probably last month or even before then, it was clear from the crisis evolving through China and mainly through Italy in mainland Europe that things were going to get worse in the United Kingdom. And as you probably saw in the media, there was a real concern that there wouldn't be enough intensive care beds. Consequently, hospitals all around the country, as well as the various Nightingale hospitals, started up and requested and asked for volunteers who would essentially leave their day-to-day practice and come work at the Nightingale. That's what I did. Normally, as you mentioned, I'm a cardiologist. I look after heart problems and specifically heart rhythm problems. But that service, to a large extent, has essentially been put on ice because of the pandemic, like most other operations. Therefore, I felt that I'd be really most use in an environment, even though it's not well known to me, intensive care. I'm used to looking after sick patients, and so I thought I would be of some use. And so put my name forward, and a few weeks later, I'm working in the intensive care unit at the NHS Nightingale at the Excel.
So isn't this potentially, though, the most terrified that you've been in your career? Because all we hear, and obviously you would clearly as a medic have better understanding of how COVID-19 does manifest and spread itself, but of course a lot of people don't have that understanding. Frankly, even the professionals, I believe, don't have a lot of that understanding at the moment. But wasn't it all the more scary, for not such an immature word to be used, for you to actually go there and put yourself in harm's way like that?
I have to be honest, I think I'd be lying if I said that I wasn't apprehensive, scared, terrified, all of those things, both for myself, but also for my family. And I think that, yeah, it's fair to say it's pretty terrifying, to be honest. In the weeks up to the pandemic actually hitting the UK, I had several colleagues and friends over in Italy who, as you know, a few weeks ahead of us in terms of the curve of where the pandemic is going. And I was seeing stories on Twitter and social media about how they've been coping or not coping, and how they've been overwhelmed, and how doctors have had to make really difficult decisions because of a lack of ventilators. And quite frankly, that was a terrifying thought that would happen to us. So, yeah, I mean, the process of going through that and the realization that this might happen to us too in the UK was indeed very scary. But I have to say, having now worked for a few weeks at the Nightingale, even though it's scary, that apprehension has kind of turned into an energy of inspiration and motivation from working with the people that I've worked with over the last few weeks.
How does it actually compare, though, working at Nightingale, which for all intents and purposes is a hospital, but it's not a hospital at the same time. It was not a purpose-built building to be a hospital, but obviously it's been made into one. How does it compare to, say, working in a purpose-built one? I hope that you've been adequately provided for.
Yeah, so you're right. It's a convention centre, and funnily enough, I've been there numerous times. The last time I was there was only probably 6 months ago, lecturing as I was on cardiology on something to do with pacemakers, which I have particular interest in. And here I am 6 months later working in this makeshift hospital within this big convention centre. So I think, firstly, the amazing thing is the sheer ability of the people involved to actually come together and make a hospital within a few weeks is quite frankly remarkable. Just the achievement of being able to do that. But of course, it's completely different. It's a big convention centre. It's a big room, a big hall, and you've got intensive care beds, monitors that are bleeping and beeping all the time. And the main struggle actually is the PPE, not the supply of it. We've been perfectly adequately supplied with it. The problem is actually doing a 12 and a half hour, 13 hour shift with it on. All lines of communication are completely different when you are in a mask, when you've got a hairnet on, a visor, a gown, gloves. And all you have to really communicate is your name on the top of the visor and the eyes of the person opposite you that you're talking to. You have to shout, you have to use hand signals, because the usual lines of communication and nonverbal communication that we kind of take for granted when you're next to someone completely go out the window. And so when you're managing someone who's particularly sick, and even managing, for example, cardiac arrests, which I've been involved with, it's quite challenging to do what you normally do, but in the full PPE. And I think that's probably what I've found, and a lot of colleagues have found, the most challenging thing.
I have to say, I think there'll be a great number of people who are quite relieved to hear that you have had an adequate supply of personal protective equipment, because of course that has in itself caused a great concern for many people, with reports that some people don't necessarily have access to it. So I'm sure it's a great relief to many to know that you do. What would you say to anyone who's listening to this now, who maybe has found all of the information out there completely and utterly overwhelming, but maybe have some sort of concerns for their own health? What's the first thing those individuals should do in order to behave responsibly?
Well, I think the most important thing for people to realize is that the virus itself doesn't actually move. It doesn't transmit. We transmit it. We are the incubators as humans. And therefore, if we move around and go about our business as usual, then we transmit it and we move it from one to another. And that directly contributes to infecting more people. And that's therefore why we need to encourage everyone to strongly keep to the government guidance of staying at home, because that really does protect the NHS. And by doing that, less people get infected. And we've started to see the numbers, I hope, start to come down. And by doing that, that really does save lives. So that's really the most important message. If people are feeling some of the symptoms, then there is guidance on NHS 111 about what to do, particularly if they're not feeling very well and feel like they might need to go to hospital. Another really important thing that I would like to add is that there's a lot of patients with non-coronavirus symptoms that relate to other diseases, heart attacks, strokes, etc. And we have seen a drop off in a number of those presenting to hospital because people are so scared about catching coronavirus. And it's really, really important that patients understand that if they do have symptoms that are of concern and that they would have called an ambulance anyway, then they should still call an ambulance. The NHS is still here for those people, and we want to treat those people. We don't want them to stay at home.
I'd say that is sound advice. And of course, to anyone who is listening who would like more information, I would say that a good place to start would be nhs.uk/coronavirus. You know, as you were talking, there was one thing that dawned on me, that it must be pretty amazing that you have all different medical professionals from all different walks of life coming together in a bid to try and battle this, what's being dubbed the invisible enemy. Can you give us a little bit of an insight as to what it's like for, say, you as a cardiologist to say maybe suddenly find yourself working with someone who's more into respiratory work or someone who maybe is more into neuroscience? What is all of that like for you?
So I think that's actually, for me, been one of the most incredible and inspirational things over the last few weeks. I've worked on the intensive care unit staffed by intensivists, but also staffed by people like myself, heart specialists, eye surgeons, shoulder surgeons, psychiatrists, general practitioners, and a whole range of people who are not used to working on intensive care unit. And yet we've all come together to help and do our bit. Because it's intensive care, patients require all different types of care and therapy, and it's very intensive by the name, by definition. And so it needs a lot of people. And that's been the most amazing thing, working with people who, for this type of care, is really uncomfortable and difficult because it's not an area that they're used to. But with the proper support and guidance run by the intensivists, we're all able to come together. And if I may just share just one last snippet, one of the most memorable things that I'll never forget was when one of our first patients was extubated. So that's when the breathing tube, that when they're normally asleep and breathes for them because they can't, when that's taken out and they can breathe for themselves. And the first patient, when they were extubated, when the tube was taken out, they were wheeled from one end of the ward to the other, the step-down ward, if you like. And completely spontaneously, as they were wheeled from one end to the other, everyone could see what was happening. And everyone just suddenly stopped and turned around and looked at this patient. And there was a rapturous applause from everyone. And despite all of the PPE, you could see everyone in everyone's eyes how delighted they were that we got a patient through this horrible disease. And I don't think I will ever forget that as long as I live. And within a few minutes, everyone turned around and got on with their job. But it was really the most incredible experience.
And I don't think that for as long as any of us live that we will forget the incredible work that you and your colleagues are doing in order to try and keep us, well, frankly, safe and, dare I say, alive. Dr. Jonathan Bihar, consultant cardiologist and electrophysiologist, thank you very much indeed for not just speaking to me on the JM podcast, but more importantly, for everything that you're doing and your colleagues to try and help all of us enjoy our lives for as long as possible. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wow. Just stopping to think for a moment there what the likes of Dr. Jonathan Bihar and so many of his colleagues must go through on a daily basis at the moment is absolutely mind-blowing. Thank you to him and indeed to all of our guests. Thank you to His Excellency Neil Wigan, OBE, of course, British Ambassador to the State of Israel. Thank you to Alex Brummer, who's city editor at the Daily Mail, for sharing his thoughts on the state of the economy at the moment. Thank you also goes to Bridget Grant and, of course, Richard Ferrer for sharing their thoughts on the paper review. And we must say thank you as well to Justin Cohen, who has produced this episode of the JN podcast. And more importantly, I say thank you for listening. I would say that if you'd like to get in touch with us, then you are most welcome to do so. You can email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. Please feel free to share your thoughts with us. And you are also welcome to find out more information on any of the stories that we've covered at jewishnews.co.uk. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN podcast. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.